and welcome to 2018 and a new revived House of Comments. My name is Emma Burnell and I'm a political journalist, and I'm joined by political commentator Mark Thompson. Hello, Mark.
Hello. Was that a quote from Poltergeist 2? At the very start when you said words. All right.
Yeah, it's a generic scary quote.
Yeah, okay. I am quite scared, so it did work.
Well, there you go. And I'm also joined by Nick Dennis, who is a senior member of the Bright Blue Group, which is a Tory modernising group. Is that how you describe yourself, Nick?
Well, that was a few years ago, but to be fair, that was probably the last time we signed off the podcast. I've left Bright Blue all amicably. They're a very nice bunch of people, and I'm still very friendly with Ryan. But I'm now basically leading the Tory workers, or one of the leading people of the Tory workers, conservatives who believe in the positive benefit that trade unions have on society and other such interesting ideas.
Excellent. Well, we shall enjoy discussing those at length.
isn't that we've probably discussed this before, but isn't that a slight contradiction in terms?
You may say that, Mark, but I have a really brilliant answer to that question. But as it's not on our topic list, I'll save it for another time.
Fair enough. Maybe 1 week we can debate that topic then, rather than completely derail it tonight.
Indeed, yeah. I have a lot of people coming up to me saying, "Are you a Tory?" Like pointing in my chest, saying, "Are you a Tory?" And I go, "Yeah, I am a Tory." And I feel very special today because I find out today that from Tim Bale's research that I'm even more exclusive than I thought I was. So, quid's in.
Yeah, not only are you a Tory, but aren't you quite young? I mean, particularly for a Tory.
Well, I'll let you, Emma and Mark, and all our listeners into a secret. The main reason I'm involved in politics is because even though I'm 38, I still feel young and normal when I'm involved in politics.
It is a skewed world.
Oh, yes, but I found my little corner.
You found your corner. Lovely. Well, OK, let's go straight on to our first topic of the year, which is the traditional January topic of the NHS is in crisis. It does seem to be slightly more in crisis than it has been before. We are now seeing all unessential surgeries being cancelled. There is enormous pressure on the NHS, as there is every winter, but it's got worse than last year. We don't seem to have prepared for it once again. And again, chronic underinvestment, chronic over usage. And there are also massive staff shortages, as I understand, that come from a variety of different pressures on the NHS. So what's to be done? Mark, you're probably the one with the more neutral skin in this game. So why don't you kick us off?
Well, my view on the NHS generally is that this is just going to happen, I think. I think we're getting older as a population. There are more drugs available to be able to help people live longer and to keep people going in ways that, you know, a couple of generations ago, once you got certain conditions, that was basically you probably die quite quickly. Now we can keep people alive for many years, many decades. And that's a good thing. That's a really good thing. But in the end, you are going to find whatever you did, even if we doubled the NHS budget, I'm sure within a few years, or maybe 10 or 15 years, we'd be hitting exactly the same problems again. I don't think the solution can just be money. I definitely do think it needs more money. That definitely must be true, because with all the cuts and everything that have been happening, it's obviously caused problems, and it becomes particularly critical during the winter. But long term, I think there is something or some things that will have to structurally change about the NHS. I don't quite know what. And it's such a third rail issue that as soon as any politicians try to begin to debate this, you immediately, if it's a Tory, they immediately get accused of wanting to privatise the NHS. And if they're a Labour politician, they get accused of being a Tory. So it's a very, very difficult subject to debate. But I don't think just keeping our heads down and trying to carry on the way we've gone for the last 50 years. And I know there have been various reorganisations, but the NHS is largely the same as the way it was 50 years ago in terms of everything's free at the point of use. OK, not everything, but most things. And I don't know what. It's a very, very difficult problem, but I think some things are going to have to change. And probably government, whatever government, whether it's Labour, Tory or whatever, the hand is going to be forced within the next few years to do some quite fundamental structural changes here, I think.
Nick, what's your view?
My mind just drifted back to 2010 and thinking how much I love the coalition. It was a really good time, wasn't it, Mark? When Mark was a Lib Dem and we used to agree on a lot and Emma used to shout at us when we did the podcast.
I was always
and
right,
we'll see about that. But I suppose it's one of those things, it's a bit like, you know, it's one of those Christmas traditions, as you said, Emma. I mean, you have your turkey and then a few days later you spend too much money in an overpriced bar and have a hangover in the morning on New Year's Day. And then there's a load of furore and blogs about train fares going up. And then it's followed by NHS in crisis. And I think it's one of those things that keeps on recurring. Now, the NHS being free at the point of use and being a national institution that's really important in terms of our identity in our country is something that most Conservatives and all leading Conservatives do believe in. And I think this is one of those things where Labour love to jump on this and sort of say the Conservatives are privatising the NHS, which is completely not true. And I think, unfortunately, what that means is you can't debate the issues properly. It's a massive thing which needs a lot of resources. Resources aren't unlimited and life changes in many different ways. So, you know, occasionally there will be times when there are more pressures than expected. And at those times, you have to do what's necessary. So cancelling or delaying non-emergency operations when you have a spike that you don't expect, I think is completely reasonable if you're going to have an NHS type of system, which, of course, I think you must.
I mean, the problem is, I mean, there are people I know who have had their operations cancelled several times over the last sort of few weeks and months. And it's so difficult, particularly if you have young children or a job that you have to rearrange. You've done a lot of work to get to the point where you can take off both the operation time and the recovery time. And that's, you know, what elective surgery, non-urgent surgery, is not. It's not, you know, oh, well, that's OK then, because actually you're making enormous disturbances in people's lives. You're carrying on people's pain. A lot of people are, you know, having these operations because, particularly hip operations, things like that, because they're in quite considerable pain and discomfort. So there is a real issue around just sort of cancelling these surgeries because we can't cope.
So where would you get the money from then? I mean,
if you raise taxes,
okay, fine.
We need to have an honest conversation in this country about how we fund the health service we want. And we haven't had that. No government's done that in 20 years. But, I mean, the closest we got was the penny on national insurance in the 2001 election, which Labour won in a landslide. So actually, when the circumstances are right, the public are willing to pay for the NHS that they want. But we just need to be able to have the honest conversation about it.
Well, Emma, though, it wouldn't a fairer compare, because the Tories were absolutely down and out in the 2001 general election. Labour had such a massive majority and the momentum was so much behind Blair anyway. Wouldn't it be a fairer comparison would be when it was a very close run election? If one party then decided to put a penny or two on income tax or national insurance in order to pay for the NHS, that's when it would tell, isn't it? That's when the risk that you might lose 20 or 30 marginal seats because of you wanting to raise taxes, that's the problem, isn't it?
Well, I mean, that we shall see, because, I mean, I think that the last election campaign, you know, the spectre of Jeremy Corbyn raising your taxes was certainly raised by the Conservative campaign. So, you know, that's...
Sorry, can we call it by its proper name? The Terrible Conservative Campaign.
That's very polite of you, Mark. Yeah,
terrible, I don't know if we're trying to go for a U rating anymore on this podcast. Actually, we're going to talk about Toby Young yesterday later on, so I'm pretty sure we won't keep the clean rating.
Me and Emma watched the results come in on the 2017 election, because we're doing, our traditional Northern Irish radio broadcast. Yeah. And as it was after the 9 o'clock watershed, the presenter said, "You are allowed to say some naughty words." And I did say some naughty words about the result, I have to say. But I won't repeat them now, because obviously I do know that podcasts can be listened to by anyone at any time of the day. But
I was on local BBC radio. I wasn't allowed to swear at all. That's not fair. I want to get. I want to go on RTE next time.
Tonight on RTE.
Yeah.
It was. Except I don't think the presenter was expecting the level of swearing that came out once the barrier had been released. But anyway, yes. But we won't talk about the election campaign. Boys. Yeah. Back to the NHS.
I think it may be the case, but the problem is, Mark, is that we are not having that honest conversation. And that's what we need to have two honest conversations, one about the NHS and one about social care.
Yeah, I agree.
And actually, those need to be basically the same conversation.
Yeah.
Now, there are different levels at which you can integrate the NHS and social care, because at the moment, social care is done by local government. The NHS is obviously national, NHS England and, England and Wales, and then NHS Scotland. Where you integrate that is incredibly complicated. Personally, I would, because I'm a devolutionist, I would do it on a more local level basis. But there are huge tensions between the two organisations as to how that would work. Ultimately, everyone has to get over that and actually build the system that doesn't fall down. Because if people are still protecting their budgetary pots for this year, and not thinking about the most important thing, which is what happens in 5-10 years' time when the NHS needs to be completely transformed, then they won't do the hard yards to, A, make the case for increased funding, which does need to be made and does need to happen, and, B, make the case for a better system of social care, a better system of public health, a better system of preventative health. At the moment, we have a national sickness service rather than a national health service. It would be much better to be flooding money into prevention, which would save, in the long run, a great deal of money.
Oh, the libertarians won't like that, Emma.
Sorry?
The libertarians won't like that.
Well, when have I ever spent my life caring what libertarians think of me?
And libertarians would applaud you for that, Emma. But interestingly, my local doctor's surgery has contacted me a number of times about getting the flu jab, which I didn't get in the end because I'm not such a fan of it. Because I've got diabetes, essentially, I'm on the list of people who can get it for free. And essentially, the reason why they were contacting me so much is because there is a financial incentive for them to do preventative stuff. So I think there is some sort of nudge and movement towards that. I mean, Emma, I'm obviously I don't know if it makes great podcasting, but I completely agree with a lot of what you said, especially about the social care aspect. Now, in another hat that I wear in my life is I'm a local councillor in London Borough of Hillingdon, and one of my observations is that link between local boroughs and the local NHS trusts just doesn't work as well as it should. Mm-hmm. And it should work really well, because actually they all feed into each other, because local authorities now have obviously a lot more responsibility on social care and also responsibility on wellbeing along with the NHS. Now, I would be in favour of actually making local NHS trusts democratically accountable in the same way that was done with police commissioners, or maybe moving it into local government, because the issue I think we have is we have these two different organisations which, you know, you're right, budgets and you know, where they're spent. I mean, it's the same issue with schools, actually, to be honest, as well, are very protective, which leads to sort of not joined up thinking, actually. So that's where I would focus.
I mean, I would take slight issue with having an equivalent for the PCCs, just because I don't know that we're getting a whole lot more democracy for our democracy, if you know what I mean.
Mm.
Like, no one's joining in those elections. It's just adding a layer of unnecessary politics. Now, as someone who loves politics and gets involved in politics all the time, that's fine, except that I don't want the NHS to be even more of a political football than it is now. And if you turn that into 350 elections and people who will only make policy on 5-year electoral cycles, I would really worry about what difference that would make to how that would politicise changes in the NHS even more than they are now.
Mark, what do you think about all of this?
I don't know. I wonder if things like this is a little bit, I'm not sure this will go down well with Labour type people. We'll find out. But things like, you know, tax breaks for people being able to go private. Because I just think, like, part of the solution here surely is going to be to try and relieve some of the pressure on the NHS. I mean, I think there are already some things like we have a healthcare scheme in work, and there probably are tax breaks for that. But not everyone is in that position. But maybe, you know, people who are running their own businesses and stuff or whatever. I don't know. I just wonder if we maybe need to be a bit more creative about this stuff. I think that one of the problems is the issue we have in this country is almost the exact opposite of the issue that America has. Now, whenever I watch the debate about healthcare in America, I'm absolutely astonished at how like 80-90% of Americans seem terrified of this idea of having a kind of what they call socialized medicine with the death panels and all of that stuff. You saw the rhetoric a few years ago. It just seems crazy to me. But in this country, we seem to have the opposite issue, that the NHS is like a kind of religion. It's like a kind of sacred cow, and you can't criticize it. And if you do criticize it, then, you know, you're going against the country. You're going against the NHS. If any politician does it, you know, they're vilified for it. I mean, politicians almost have to preface any sentence about the NHS with, of course, the NHS is wonderful. And then they can say what was that they wanted to say. And I don't know. I think we need to be less hidebound. I think we need to think outside the box more, because I don't really see how we're going to get out of this problem if we don't.
Well, I actually disagree with you, Mark, on the tax breaks for those who use private healthcare. And the reason why is because the NHS is not a consumer service. It doesn't exist for me and what I do. What it exists for, as much as anything else, is creating, you know, a good and equitable society where, you know, the person in the bus queue next to me is also healthy, and also the bus driver doesn't need to worry about their health. And I think if you start giving tax breaks for those who can use private services, you'll also actually be essentially elevating people who can afford it to a better level of care.
So
You would
create a two-tier system. We already have a two-tier system. But the only alternative to that then is to put up taxes quite significantly. A penny on income tax on national insurance ain't going to cut it. It'll need to be more than that. That might be a sticking plaster for the next 2-4 years. It won't do it for the long term. We would need to get used in this country to paying several percentage points more in tax than we actually do eventually.
Well, you need to do two things. You need to, first of all, you need to change the way that the money is invested in the NHS. And part of the problem is that the NHS tends to be quite hierarchical, and it's run by surgeons. And surgeons like to operate on people. It's what they do. And that's the most expensive thing you can do in the NHS. But it's where a lot of the money goes because of the hierarchy within the NHS. So if we can flip that around and actually do much more prevention, much more early intervention to stop people getting to the point where they need that kind of extreme intervention, then we would save a great deal of money. Now, that great deal of money needs to be reinvested. It doesn't need to be saved as a tax saving. But it then doesn't mean we're talking 7 percentage points. We are talking about tax rises, and there are no two ways about it. And frankly, any politician worth their salt should be saying that at the moment. They should be preparing the ground for that, because that is what's needed to save the service that, as you say, Mark, is so beloved.
Yeah, but
if it is that beloved,
I was just going to say,
go ahead.
Yeah, can I just ask a really stupid question?
Always.
Yeah, I quite like asking stupid questions. There are a hell of a lot of very, very clever people involved in running the NHS, far cleverer than me. How come none of them have thought of what you've just said?
Well, I have. There's two issues. The five-year forward view is actually looking at doing the first steps of quite a lot of this. Simon Stevens' stuff is actually very good. Five-year view on mental health. I was commissioned to write an article, and no spoilers because it's not come out yet, but the picture of what's happened in the terms of the five-year forward view for mental health is actually a lot better than I expected it to be. The services are turned around quite interestingly. The problem is the increased pressure is coming, particularly in terms of mental health, but also a lot of physical health problems have come from 7 years of austerity. So there are a lot more problems that are building up because people haven't got secure housing, they haven't had wage rises, they haven't got secure jobs. So there are a lot of issues, particularly in mental health, that are not caused by the NHS or the lack of NHS services, but other things putting pressure on the NHS. So So again, we need to be much, much more holistic about how we look at things.
But this is where government, just quickly, this is where government is always awful, actually, at being holistic. This is the issue. I agree with you completely. But how do we break that down? How do we make government think holistically?
Well, I mean, that's the complicated question, because at the moment the NHS is trying to think holistically about a massive, massive service that is not in itself holistic. But to have them then talk to, for example, the Department for Education or the Department of Communities and Local Government, to actually make sure that everybody is talking to each other, that is something that nobody's properly cracked, but has to come from the cabinet, has to come from the top. And Mark, the other part of your question is, you know, people are trying to crack this within the NHS, within the funding restraints that they've got. And nobody on the political side is actually doing the we need to raise taxes argument. And so, you know, Simon Stevens has come out there and quite strongly said, I want my 350 million. I don't think he plucks that number out of the air. he said, I want 350 million a year, but, you know, it was a week, it was promised.
I think your best chance of getting the 350 million a week is for Boris Johnson to become Prime Minister, because I think the pressure on him would be so great in whatever leadership campaign led to that I think he'd have to promise to actually do it.
Is this a historical moment? Have we launched Emma for Boris tonight?
No, because I don't believe he'd do it in a heartbeat.
I don't think he'd want to do it. I think he'd be forced to do it.
I think he would be forced to do it as well, actually. So, yeah. Emma for Boris.
That barefaced, he wouldn't do it.
He'd be sitting behind the desk, he'd just suddenly rubbish head, oh, crikey.
I think ultimately we're not all disagreeing. We probably have different emphasis on where the tax incentives or tax breaks or tax rises should go. But it's a complicated political question. It probably needs, and I think there was an attempt to do this. There have been various attempts to do this, and various partisans have stopped it happening. If you're going to change the NHS long term, your plan has to be a 20-year plan. If you're going to have a 20-year plan, you have to have cross-party consensus on what that plan is. It's going to have to include social care. It's going to have to look in the round at public health, social care, the NHS, and investment and taxes. And everybody who could ever conceivably be in cabinet over those 20 years needs to be bought into that and needs to be tied into that. And that's the difficult political project.
Does that include Nick Dennis? Because, you know, he's only 38. He's probably in 20 years' time, he probably will be in the cabinet.
No, I'm staying in the I'm not in the cabinet. I won't be in the cabinet.
We'll see.
I'll probably still be doing House of Commons podcast with you guys.
I might just slip down to Ladbrokes tomorrow and put a bit of money on it. 20 years is a long time in politics.
If you're hoping that'll fund your long-term social care needs, Mark, I think you're going to be disappointed. But anyway.
Well, I think we're probably done with the NHS. But speaking of unusual bets, if someone had told me 2 weeks ago that Toby Young was going to be the man in charge of reinvigorating freedom of speech on our university campuses, I would have put money on it and lost. So, Nick, you're our resident Tory.
I am.
Yay, Toby Young.
Well, firstly, so I did a little Twitter poll, and my followers have basically said that he can look after himself, so I don't need to defend him. But I am going to say a couple of things, because I think it is important that a little bit of perspective is brought into this. Firstly, the role he's been appointed to is essentially a member of a board that looks into sort of standards and quality and student experience for university graduates, and so he's not leading it. He's not a leading member of it. He's not doing the free speech stuff either. So he is one of a number of board members. Secondly, he does have experience in the free school, setting up free schools and all this sort of stuff. So he does have some education experience. I think in terms of appointing him from those perspectives, I'm not too bothered about. I don't really have a strong opinion. I have to admit, having looked at the makeup of the Quango, I do. the overall makeup does seem to be quite a lot of Quango kings and queens on it, and I think there should be more student representation. So I think the real issue is not actually Toby Young. It's actually it seems to be the same people who sit on lots of different Quangos doing whatever they do on these Quangos. I don't know.
Do you remember the bonfire of the Quangos? Whatever happened to that?
Well, I think they ended up creating two Quangos to monitor it. but two very quick points. Firstly, the stuff he wrote that the Guardian, you know, found completely offended me. And the stuff he said on inclusivity, was not witty banter, would have offended and hurt people who don't need to be offended and hurt. So I'm offended. I'm even offended that it was published. I mean, he's apologized for that and said he didn't really mean it. But, you know, free speech is fine. But free speech allows me to say that that was completely out of order. And even as a sort of, a joke or as a provocateur, you know, that was below acceptable standards. His stuff on eugenics, I think it completely misses the point about life and the value of life and what people do. Maybe stirring the pot for the debate, but completely not acceptable and just completely inhumane, actually. And obviously the long time ago when he wrote about stains, working class people going to university. I mean, just shows he's obviously got some serious attention deficit issues. So he's apologized for all of those, and that's okay. But he really now needs to prove that he's moved way beyond that through his actions and through doing a bloody good job on this board in order to help make sure that it does its job, because that's the only way that actually the situation can turn into a good situation.
And that's the problem, isn't it? Because I don't think Toby Young, on his own merits, has ever done a bloody good job in his life. He may have set up some free schools, but they've had West London Free School had 4 heads in 6 years. That's not good running of a school. He's not set it up in a way that works. He may have been got a lot of plaudits for doing a free school, but if you can't actually make it work properly, then you don't deserve to be plaudited. I don't know if plaudit is the word, but there you go. There are two issues, I think, with the appointment of Toby Young. First of all, he's not there on merit. I mean, there is a queue of people a mile long who would be better in that role than him. He's there to do a particular thing, which is wind up the left, wind up liberals, wind up people who think he's a cock. I think we can get away with cock. I won't use the word I used last time, Mark.
Well, I think we should just remind listeners, we did have Toby Young as a guest on this podcast. Must have been, 3 years ago now, 4 years ago. And you actually used a very creative way of asking him a question that actually called him the worst word in the English language. So much so, I had to bleep it. That was the only bleep I ever actually did of that. of that series of the podcast. Yes, you were, weren't you? I remember. You were surprised I bleeped it as well, actually. I think you were slightly disappointed.
I was disappointed. Where were your liberalism then?
Well, I was just trying to keep some modicum of glee. We used to say like shit and bollocks and stuff, but I just felt that one was a bit too far.
See, you know, even every liberal, and scratch the surface of any liberal, you find a conservative.
Are you going to ask me about Toby Young, Emma, seeing as you're the host?
Yeah, Mark, what's your view?
So what is your view? As a liberal, should he be this bastion? Is he the great bastion of freedom of speech?
Well, I'm a bit conflicted because there have been lots of occasions when people have said and done and tweeted and blogged and written stupid, offensive things. And, you know, there's been stories about them and they've been asked to resign or, you know, pressured to resign from this, that or the other. And I usually fall on the side of give them a chance, you know, people are allowed to have a history, allowed to have a past. But quite often those things, when they've done them, when they were young, when they were, they probably didn't know any better, or before they had any sort of role in the kind of public life, whether it be media or journalism or politics or whatever. I don't think that really applies to Toby Young. Some of these disgusting things that he was tweeting were like a couple of years ago, and he's like 50 odd. It's not like these are youthful indiscretions. He just is not a nice person. He's basically a right-wing troll. And he seems to be being rewarded for that by being given a position of great influence. I mean, I don't know how much.
Well, it's not a position of great influence.
Well,
come on,
this has filled
a bit of space on Twitter and Facebook during a time when news is political quiet. He's basically a board member of some quango I'd never heard of, would never have heard of otherwise. Quangos don't tend to do that much anyway. He's
why appoint him? That doesn't really make any sense.
Well, why have
the quango? That's when you think about why they've appointed him, which we'll get on to carry on.
Let's not overegg his role and his influence and all this sort of stuff.
Okay, all right, okay.
I tell you what, one of the things that annoys me the most as a conservative who spends a lot of time trying to convince people that the Conservative Party do care and are for all working people. And Emma, stop laughing, but it's true. It's what I believe.
I wasn't laughing. I was sniggering.
Okay, fair enough. But what really annoyed me so much is we've now given a bunch of fire back to Labour and Momentum in order to put out this negative stereotypes of conservatives being elitist and not caring and being a chumocracy. And that's what's really annoyed me the most, actually, is we've just without realise whoever did this, not realizing the consequences of it in terms of our reputation and our sort of how we're seen, it's just idiotic. And that's the thing that annoys me the most.
I think I have a more fundamental objection to Toby Young's appointment than just the nasty stuff that he's written and said over the years, because I think there probably is quite a strong argument for saying that should disbar him from the office that he's been appointed to or the board that he's been appointed to, whatever it is. But I think that's up for debate. My more fundamental objection is he really isn't very bright. I wrote a blog post about him a few years ago. I listened to him on Any Questions for about 5 minutes. And I've actually met him as well. And I was on a panel with him at the Times Educational Festival in about 2013 or something. So I've seen him firsthand as well. But in this Any Questions, he tried to use the argument that democracy doesn't work because Chris Huhne had broken the law and had to resign. But then the Lib Dems had subsequently won the seat. So, he said, where's your democracy there? And it's like, there was another thing on that episode. Well, I can't exactly remember what it was. I blogged about it a few years ago. I did reread it the other day. I can't remember the details, but it basically, towards the end of the blog post, my description was, that's basically how a child would understand how politics works. There's a kind of infantile thing going on here. And I just don't think people who don't seem to have rigorous critical thinking skills should be appointed to roles like this. Whether you think it's important or not, Nick, the government's created the board. They've put people on the board. And I think it's just jobs for the boys. I think they've just given it to Toby Young because he's Boris Johnson and Joe Johnson's mate. He's a good egg in quotes in that respect. And they've just popped him on because, he's a face that fits. And I don't think especially when Theresa May stood outside Downing Street just as she became Prime Minister and was talking about things like meritocracy and trying to make sure that people can get on in life. What kind of message is this sending to people? I think it's terrible.
I absolutely agree with all of that, Mark. The jobs for the boys aspect of this is pretty gross. The fact that he's vastly, vastly unqualified is pretty gross. But I think there's a deeper story going on here, which is that the Tories have made a choice about what they're going to be doing that, and they have gone full Trump. And I mean, they're not very good at it.
They haven't gone full Trump.
Your one saving grace is that Theresa May is useless at everything she does. But when you can draw a direct line from Citizens of Nowhere to this appointment, there is to Joe Johnson's kickoff just before Christmas about all these freedom of speech on campus issues, that they are going full on culture war. 2018 is going to be the year that Tories make overt what has been covert, that the way that they see Brexit and the way that they see their path to victory post-Brexit is by stirring up the Trumpian-style culture wars that they think will get their older voters back out voting, because they've given up on trying to attract young people, as far as I can see. And if you don't do this appointment, if the people you want to attract back are the students. So they've given up on that. So their basic plan is to try to reinvigorate that base of older voters who they turned off with their social care plans in the manifesto.
I mean, I'm absolutely outraged by the left's outrageousness of this sort of culture war type of thing, when basically over the last 2 years, and especially in the last general election, Labour and Momentum and all those people have been chucking loads of culture war type stuff at us. The first sort of Trumpian politician in the UK politics was obviously Farage and UKIP, but the next Trumpian politician is Corbyn. You know, he's not the same in terms of his overall beliefs, but in terms of all this way of operating, it's similar. And so to sort of shout at the right for trying to start a culture war from the left is completely hypocritical.
As you know, I'm not always the biggest fan of Jeremy Corbyn, and I'll criticise him where I think he deserves criticism. Mm-hmm. But how is Jeremy Corbyn starting a culture war in terms of kicking down, in terms of dividing people, in terms, you know, I think he's been dreadful on Brexit, so I will say that there's quite a bit there that I'd be happy to criticise. But I think that the embrace of that nasty narrow-mindedness of the anti-intellectualism of Trumpism, which is where this is coming from, you know, is actually so corrosive. I've been doing a lot of reading on Watergate. I'm writing an essay on Watergate, and I'll probably bring that back in when we come to our next topic. But one of the things that's so clear is this constant refrain from the 60s of, it's just the liberal metropolitan elite. And by that, what they meant then was white people who cared about black people. And what they mean now is white people who care about black people and sometimes Muslim people.
Oh, wow. I mean, Labour's whole strategy is for the many, not for the few, and the few being a different sort of elite. It's about attacking, you know, rich bankers. I mean, if you want me to bring up the anti-Semitism, if you want me to bring up Corbyn supporting the Cuban regime that locks up political prisoners, gay people and independent trade unions, I'm happy
all
to.
Of which I'm happy
if,
to
yeah, like massively, you know, massively, massively serious stuff. If you want me to bring up the terrible, intimidating behaviour of many Labour activists during the 2017 election, and can I say specifically as well, targeted at Conservative women as well? There's a massive misogynist streak within the current Labour Party, as well as an anti-Semitic streak, and that is all fueled from the top. It's fueled, you know, for me, the big moment for Corbyn that redefines.
You can't do it, can you, Nick?
The big moment. For me, that defined who Corbyn was when at the launch of this anti-Semitism report, essentially one of your Labour MPs, a Jewish lady, was starting to be berated by somebody in the crowd, and Jeremy Corbyn didn't do anything. A leader at that point would have stepped in and said, no, this is not what we're about. And that tells me everything you need to know about this man. And I am reacting to you accusing the Conservatives of starting a culture war, which is completely not true. We have some people on the right, and Toby Young is one of them, who play into this culture war narrative, and that's how they make money. James Dellingpole's another
Theresa
one.
Theresa May has adopted it wholesale, and that is what your 2018 is going to be.
100%
and in 6
not.
Months' time, when we do this podcast, and I point out to you that I was right, I hope that you will accept it. Because
Theresa
I'm fighting
do
on a regular basis things about anti-Semitism and misogyny in the Labour Party. I try to make the Labour Party better. I do not ignore its failings. And if you continue to ignore what is happening in your party, then you will continue to lose that fight.
I do not ignore what's happening in my party. I am fighting for, you know what I fight for, Emma. Theresa May.
I know, but then you have
Theresa May is
to
not
say what they're doing, which is exactly what they're doing.
Look,
by making this appointment, they know exactly what they're doing. This is a political appointment.
It's a tiny speck in the whole government landscape. It is not a big, massive culture war conspiracy. And that's all I'm going to say on it now, as well as we can have the same argument again and again.
Fine. Well, I mean, in 6 months' time, we will revisit the many, many other specks in the firmament of Theresa May's culture war.
Just before we move on, I don't agree that Theresa May and that the Tory government are fomenting a culture war. I think there are elements within the Tory right who are, but there always have been. And I think there are elements within the left who are fomenting something similar. And I think they're getting more coverage nowadays because things have become more polarised and because it's easy to draw comparisons with Trump. But if you compare what's happening in America, they're a million miles away from what's going on here, thank God.
Yeah, we get America sneezes, we catch cold. We're catching that cold. If we're not careful, we're going to really, really see.
I agree, if we're not careful, we could go down that road, especially with Brexit and the polarisation that's causing.
Yeah,
I agree,
Brexit,
but I don't think we're anywhere near
nowhere.
It now.
That wasn't a mini speech. That was a party conference speech when she told me I wasn't a proper citizen of my country. Yeah, this is what I'm talking about. There is a direct line and it runs through the government. Anyway, speaking of American politics, we are recording this on Thursday, the
fourth of January.
It's still very sort of post Christmas. And today there has been some extracts released from a new book on Donald Trump, which do not shed the most favourable light on the president of the US. Mark, do you want to outline, given that me and Nick were mostly involved in that last ding dong, do you want to outline what we heard there?
Yeah. So, I mean, everything that I have read about what's in that book, I wasn't surprised about any of it at all. Frankly, if you use the theory of Occam's razor, I would probably have come to the conclusion that the things that it says in the book that we've now discovered were happening behind the scenes were happening anyway, because he's clearly just completely chaotic. He clearly didn't want to be president, never expected to win, and couldn't believe that he'd actually won. He's completely unsuitable for office. He doesn't do any of the things that you would expect a president to do. He's completely unpresidential. In fact, he's redefining the word presidential. He's actually degrading the word, because he is the president, and therefore what's presidential is what he does, and what he does is disgusting, frankly. He is the worst president that the US has ever had, certainly in my lifetime and from any of the presidents I've studied from history. And some of the stuff that's in that book, just his absolute ego-driven inability to focus and concentrate, inability to read. He seems to be semi-literate. From what I've heard that before, but this book is saying that he is basically functionally illiterate. He can't really read. Maybe he can actually read the words, but he seems unable to focus for more than a few seconds. So effectively, he can't really read. He needs people to just read stuff to him. And even then, he just drifts off. He goes round and round in rambling circles. People just can't get him to focus on things. He just signs executive orders without understanding what's in them. Someone sat down with him when he was a candidate and tried to explain the Constitution to him. And when they got to the Fourth Amendment, he just wasn't interested anymore and ended up forcing them to talk about something else. I mean, like I say, none of this is surprising, but I think it's just worth reiterating this stuff and just kind of highlighting it for what it is. It's preposterous that this man is president of the United States. It's become so normalized now that when he tweets this crap that he tweets, this kind of, you know, stuff where he's baiting Kim Jong-un that could cause a nuclear war. It could cause a nuclear war. That is not an exaggeration. It could. And people just laugh it off and say, well, Trump is Trump, whatever. You know, yeah, it doesn't matter. Yes, it matters. It matters immensely. I simply can't imagine any former holders of that office, even Ronald Reagan, who was a bit, you know, he was a bit doolally himself, certainly towards the end. Even Reagan wouldn't have done any of the stuff that Trump's done. It is just amazing that he's president. And he's actually trying to get the book squashed now. He's trying to get it, trying to force the publishers to not publish it. I'm pretty sure that'll fail. But what is so incredible to me about this is that there's still about 30-odd% of the American voting public who think he's doing a good job. I've seen interviews with them. I've seen footage of interviews with them. And it is simply like I'm looking at an alien species. How can they watch this man and think that he's anything other than what he is, which is a silver-spooned blowhard who doesn't give a shit about anyone except himself?
I mean, I couldn't agree more with that. Everything you've just said. I mean, some of the assertions, they all echo other things that we've heard. There is a question with the author. And I mean, as someone described him on Twitter as the US's Johann Harry. So we do need to be a bit cautious at taking everything with a slight pinch of salt. But as you say, the Occam's razor and the mountains of evidence that already existed in the various interviews that we've already seen with people like Maggie Haberman, you know, this is what the Trump regime is like. And the most fascinating thing is how dysfunctional not just the man himself, but the entire White House operation is. And the fact that they run the Senate and the House of Representatives, and they cannot pass legislation. And they managed to get one thing, which was a tax bill that's going to cripple the country. I mean, absolutely, yeah, and is even less popular than their attempt to repeal healthcare. So it's going to, you know, do them huge disservice in their upcoming elections. But, you know, they are the Congress are completely in awe of him. I don't think they're in awe of him as a person. They all think he's a muppet at best, a moron at worst, an evil moron at worst. But actually, because they have to go through their primaries this year, they are just, they know that their Trump voters are going to vote them out and elect a Roy Moore instead, and then lose a seat like Alabama, because the people they will lose their seats to are so batshit crazy. Nick, do you want to join this one? Or ask him to defend Trump?
No. Well, I thought what was really interesting about what's come out is how he expected and a lot of people around him wanted to lose, and they never even thought that he would win. So they didn't even bother preparing for what would happen if he won, which is, as we all know, if you get elected as president of the USA, your first 100 days is so important. So if you haven't even bothered to set up what you're going to do during that time, then you're going to waste a lot of time. So I think that was absolutely fascinating, because obviously he sort of ran against Mitt Romney in the primaries last time and then sort of dropped out of the primaries. And that was so obviously just a stunt to promote himself and his TV, The Apprentice. So it's almost like he did the same thing again. But this time it's sort of he started winning and he seemed to just do more crazier stuff, thinking that, of course, that he'll end up losing if he does all this crazy stuff. But he kept on winning. He was obviously caught in this circle of hell where he thought, if I do this more outrageous thing, then of course I'm going to lose. Then he kept on winning. So the real question is, what the hell is going on that makes a majority of people vote for someone like Donald Trump?
Well, okay, first of all, it wasn't a majority. It was the weird electoral college system that actually Hillary Clinton got 2 million more votes than Trump. There was
3 million.
Yeah, 3 million. There was a fascinating piece that I read the other day, which I was going to say, and I've now completely forgotten. Emma, jump in and save me. I'll remember it in a minute.
Okay, well, I think there are, the electoral college is a huge issue. There's been gerrymandering for years, which makes a lot of the districts, particularly in the House of Representatives, absolutely bonkers. So in the recent Alabama election, even though Doug Jones won a majority, the way that the districts are set out, the Republicans would have won 6 out of 7 of their House of Representatives seats. And that's just crazy. That's not democracy. That's not democracy as anybody can possibly recognise it. So there are huge, huge problems with gerrymandering. But again, an awful lot of the problems are internal to the Republican Party. There's a huge battle going on between traditional conservatives, fiscal hawks, and the Tea Party nutters who, were being led by Steve Bannon and Donald Trump. They've massively fallen out over this book. But I mean, as little as 3 weeks ago or so, Trump was campaigning for Bannon's candidate in Alabama, a known child molester. All of the House of Representatives and the Senate have completely lost their bottle, because they know that if they stand up to these idiots who are wrecking the country, the only response they'll get will be to lose their own seats. Now, some of them should probably do that and put country before party, but very, very few of them are willing to do so. There are some interesting parallels. Nick, you're going to like this one. I mean, when you say imagine not preparing for winning an election, imagine putting in your election manifesto purely to bargain it away in a coalition agreement, a massively damaging vote on Brexit, for example.
I think you'd love to sort of connect the Conservative Party to Trump. I don't really see
I'm not doing that, to be fair. I'm really not. I'm making a parallel. I'm not running them along the same track. I do think that the Conservative parties are moving towards those cultural wars. As I've said, that does not mean I think that they're going to actually have the kind of connection. I mean, I think Theresa May should not have rushed over there. That was a huge mistake. And the whole hand-holding picture, all of that nonsense, we've got a deal on NATO. No, we haven't, because he has not a consistent man. This is the problem with Trump. You cannot deal with him the way that we've always dealt with other US presidents and tried to exert influence, because he just listens to the last person he spoke to.
Yeah, I remember seeing people who are in favour of Brexit on Twitter just after Trump had said something about we're going to get a really good deal, and they were all kind of laughing and saying, ah, see, we're all the people who thought we were going to get a good deal now. And I just remember thinking, but what Trump says is worthless. It's literally worthless. And how can you listen to that and think that it means anything? It's not. It's just will-o'-the-wisp.
And also, one thing he said a lot was America first.
Yes, exactly. And if you believe America first, then you're not going to put the interests of the person you're negotiating a deal with before yours.
So one of the great things about social media is there's plenty of people who have too much time on their hands and they do crazy stuff. And there's this guy who set up this Twitter stream, which was essentially followed everybody who Donald Trump follows, so you could follow it and look and see what Donald Trump sees on Twitter. And as we all know, Donald Trump actually spends a lot of his day looking at Twitter and responding. And what's really interesting is when you look at that, it's basically a mixture of this sort of Tea Party commentators, shall we say, but also liberal elite institutions, if you'd want to also say, like the New York Times. So he cares and pays as much attention to CNN, New York Times, as he does to Breitbart and Kelly Conway, which is absolutely fascinating. That is the world that he looks at.
I mean, what's really interesting, the parallel, and I said I would come back to this with Nixon, is that Nixon had this absolute war on the liberal media. And they were the enemy, 100% the enemy. And Trump is doing very much the same thing. It's the liberal press. It's the lying CNN, the failing New York Times. You know, he always does this. And the amount that he's using, the same language and the same techniques that Nixon used to try and discredit the Watergate investigations, all of that stuff, is quite extraordinary. And it feels like that old parable, if you fail to remember history, you fail to learn from it. And I feel like now that Watergate has faded really from living memory for most people, and it happened before I was born, and I'm quite old these days, it just feels like those lessons have receded, and now it's a group of people who are able to do not the same thing. Trump is not being accused of the same thing that Nixon was accused of, but a lot of the same things that have come after the things that were being done. So there is no sort of campaign of dirty tricks by Donald Trump. There may well have been a campaign of dirty tricks by Vladimir Putin. But it's the problem was never the break-in at the Watergate. It was all the other things that were done and all the things that were done to cover up what was done.
But the crazy thing about the situation, as far as I can perceive it, that's happening in the US now, is that I think Trump will fire Mueller. And I think however the investigation then pans out with whoever replaces Mueller, or maybe won't replace them, I think it'll just be a whitewash, even if he doesn't replace Mueller. And Mueller reports... and, you know, some people are prosecuted, and I don't think you can prosecute Trump, but there could be like enough evidence, and there probably will be loads of evidence of, you know, collusion or whatever else has gone on here. And he may have even found out some other stuff about Trump's business interests over the years, because, quite frankly, come on, everyone knows the sort of business he's in. You know, exactly. You know, real estate in New York. You know, come on. We all know what must have gone on there as well. And maybe he will have found some stuff like that. But I think the result will be nothing. Nothing. Because it requires a two-thirds majority in the Senate to impeach him, and they simply won't do it. And frankly, look at what he's done already in the last 11 months. If they're not willing to impeach him by now, they won't impeach him. Whatever is found, simply won't. So Trump is here until 2020.
Yes. I mean, where I think that may be wrong is if they start to see them losing their seats in 2020 because he's such a drag on the ticket. Then there may be more of a majority to impeach. I don't think you're going to get impeachment. I think you may get a forced resignation.
But he won't do it, though. Like, if the men in you know, grey suits turn up and tell him time's up, he won't go. He won't go. He'll just go on Twitter and, you know what he's like? He's not normal. When the men in grey suits went to Nixon, even though Nixon was a horrible man and a really bad president, he resigned. Trump won't do
I wonder if Trump will run again, though, because it doesn't look like he's enjoying it.
No, I don't think he will. He's hating it.
I mean, his family certainly aren't enjoying it. His wife would definitely be rather be doing other things than First Lady stuff. And I wonder if he'll just think it's not worth the hassle and he'll sort of step down and come up with some crazy reason.
That may be the deal that gets struck, is I won't run again in 2020. You won't impeach me. And then... whoever the next Republican president is, if they get another Republican, will pardon me for everything that I'm going to get found guilty of, which is basically the Ford Nixon deal.
I think once he's an ex-president, I don't think they'll go after him either. I think that's kind of like immunity at that point. I think if he avoids impeachment in office, which I think he will,
Can't indict a sitting president. You can, from what I've been reading, indict an ex-president.
But I think this transcends the legalities of the situation. Mm. I just think the politics are such that it simply won't happen. I just think it won't.
Well, I mean, I think it depends on the crime. Mm. I mean, if he kills someone on... What was it he said?
Fifth Avenue. He could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue. No, I genuinely think he could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and still nothing would happen. Genuinely. I didn't think that when he first said it. I do think it now. Genuinely.
Wow, it's interesting. Okay, well, we seem to be veering into our final topic, which is the really, really sensible, clever thing for us to do, because all of us have done so well at this in the last year. So, Mark, what are your big predictions for 2018?
I mean, I didn't even prepare for this because I've spent over the last few years, everything I've predicted has not happened. So I predicted in 2015 that the Conservatives simply couldn't win a majority, and they did. I predicted in 2016 that Brexit couldn't possibly win, and it won. I then predicted that Trump absolutely couldn't win. I even had a bet with my next door neighbour, and he won. And I then simply couldn't see how Corbyn could do anything other than get absolutely annihilated earlier this year. And he came pretty close to depriving Theresa May of office. He actually deprived her of a majority and nearly deprived her of being Prime Minister. I mean, so I'm not sure my predictions are really worth anything at all. I think
Mark, basically, I'm going to walk away from politics now. When people ask me why, I'll say it's because Mark put £10 on me being in the cabinet in 10 years' time. And based on all his other predictions, I knew I better give up and do something else.
I'll give you an example of just how wrong I was. Right,
I won't even get into the cabinet in Hillingdon.
I'll walk away from it all.
I'll give you an example of just how wrong I was. Right, I have two younger brothers, neither of whom really have ever shown any kind of inclination or interest in politics at all. I'm a bit of an oddball in my family. I know, Emma, you come from a family of people who are very politically active. My family aren't and never have been, really. They've been interested in politics.
My brother and sister aren't. It's my parents who are.
Fair enough. But my family aren't really like that. I'm the only one who's ever really shown anything like the level of interest that I currently have. And yet my youngest brother, who's 5 years younger than me, about a week before the election said, "Oh, Mark," I was chatting to him, and he said, "Oh, I saw Corbyn. Saw Corbyn yesterday." And I was like, "What, you saw Corbyn? What, you went to a political speech?" He said, "Yeah, he had a rally in Runcorn. I went down with mates, and honestly, it's one of the best things I've ever done. It was amazing. Like, he's absolutely electrified the audience, and everyone there loved him, and I'm definitely going to vote for him now." And I remember thinking, that's weird. And he said, "I think he's going to do really well." And I was trying to explain to him in my kind of patronising older brother way just how it was impossible for Corbyn to do anything other than get absolutely trounced. And then, of course, a few days later, it turns out that my brother, who doesn't really know very much about politics at all, had it absolutely right and I had it absolutely wrong. And I think the conclusion I've come to in the last few months is the fact that I know so much about politics historically is actually an impediment to me being able to predict what's going to happen now, because the tectonic plates have shifted so much that all of those kind of, you know, things like people never vote against their own self-interest and, you know, anyone who's from the far left can't possibly win elections, all of that stuff just isn't necessarily true anymore. And so therefore, I think the only thing that I am willing to predict is that Brexit is going to happen and we will reach the point of no return later this year. Because there'll come a point where it actually wouldn't be possible from the timetable perspective to be able to do anything other than leave the European Union. And I'm certain that is going to happen. All these people who are still hoping that there's a chance that we might remain, that ain't going to happen. We're leaving.
Nick?
My prediction for the year is it's for most of the year, I think it's going to be quite boring, actually. I think everything's going to sort of stay the same. I mean, We seem to be having the same Brexit arguments again and again and again, and that will continue. I mean, Tony Blair popping up this week to make the same argument again that he's always made. Fair enough, Tony. I admire your stamina. But and then getting the same responses from people back at him. That will just continue. There won't be a general election because no Conservative and the DUP don't want to lose an election, which they possibly might now, so they don't want an election. Corbyn's safe. No Labour MPs will challenge him because he's got such a strong power base. There won't be any interesting bills because of the slender majority. And I think essentially we're just going to have a sort of Groundhog Day politics, unfortunately. But what that will do, though, is it'll lead up to a head of steam where I think, you know, something's going to crack maybe towards the end of 2018 or in 2019, because there are so many challenges that need to be dealt with, not just Brexit, productivity, social care, low wages, all this sort of stuff that, it's, I think something will crack at some point, but it might not be until next year.
OK, I'm going to push you slightly. Reshuffle.
Yes. well, I think so far Theresa May has not been very adventurous on her reshuffles, which is one of the reasons why I disagree with you. Well, it was one of the reasons I disagree with you about the culture war point, because I don't think she's, that's how she sees the world. Obviously, Patrick McLoughlin has to leave as party chairman. The party operation is just drifting towards terminal decline. Chris Grayling's probably gone. He probably went to Dubai or wherever he went to because he knew he was on his way out. Obviously, Damien Green's gone. Interestingly, I don't know if Justine Greening will go. I think she's okay. She might promote some of the sort of more younger 2015 people into more junior positions. But the issue is going to be, are they going to have any material to deliver? Because if the government is just bogged down in Brexit, I mean, what is there really of interest to say? So I don't think the reshuffle is going to be particularly of interest. What I would love, and I declare an interest because he's a friend of mine, is I'd love Rob Halfen to come into government maybe and be Secretary of State for DWP or something like that, because that would show a shift in sort of thinking about how stuff should be done. And I think the Conservatives should drop austerity as well, which I don't think will happen, because actually I think austerity has run its course. But again, because of May's cautiousness and the amount of effort that's being spent on Brexit, I don't think there's any room for sort of interesting, strong manoeuvres.
Go on then, Emma, what are your predictions?
Boris? Sorry, just what about Boris, Nick, in or out?
Oh, well, he stays in, and I want him to stay in because essentially, as a leading Brexiteer, and I agree with Mark, we will Brexit, he needs to be there. I wonder when he was causing a bit of problems around Conservative Party conference if he wished to be sacked so he could go back to earning three times as much, doing half the amount of work as writing columns for the Daily Telegraph.
And not to take responsibility for anything else.
Yeah, definitely. He's a leading Brexiteer, and he really believes in it, so he should be there.
He doesn't really believe in it. Come on, Nick.
I take him at face value. Yeah.
Which face?
Yeah, good question.
So I don't have many predictions. I think, like Nick, I think at least I just hope we're going to have quite a quiet year, which probably means it's going to be a tsunami and nuclear war. I think there's going to be a big disastrous type event, another Grenfell Tower, some train crash or something that exposes the paucity of current regulations and the limits of what austerity has brought us. I don't know what it is. If you knew what it is, you'd stop it. But I think there's going to be something like that that is going to further enrage an already enraged country. I think that the Grenfell Tower report is going to be very, very bad for the government, the local council, and will have some very, very strong recommendations that will be put in a drawer and not acted on. I don't think that they will. I think they'll do a couple of the cosmetic ones and will not take up the really fundamental stuff that needs to be changed. I think that the local elections will be good for Labour. I think that's a massively controversial thing to say at the moment, the way the polls are and the way that Labour is currently has more momentum. But I think that Scotland will be worth watching for both whether the SNP go backwards. I don't know if there are local elections because they have different timetables than us. But, you know, any election that happens in Scotland in the next 18 months, the SNP, to my sense, seem to be falling back. But the beneficiary of that has been more conservative than Labour. And that's interesting to watch. So I would say keep watching Scotland. Mm. Those are my predictions.
Just before we finish, Emma, mm-hmm. am I okay to just plug another podcast?
You can if I can.
Okay, yeah. So there's this podcast that I've listened to. I've only listened to one episode of it so far. But it's really good. It's called The Zeitgeist Tapes. And it's a political commentator and a political scientist professor. And they talk about where politics and culture intersect. And the first episode was really interesting because they had a chat for about the first maybe 15, 20 minutes, just about kind of stuff that's been happening recently. But then they focused, and I think they're going to do this in every episode, on a specific kind of cultural thing and how it intersects with politics. And the first one they chose was a book which I haven't read, actually, called A Very British Coup by Chris Mullins, who used to be a Labour MP. But I think he was a Labour MP when he wrote it, but I didn't know that. I know now I've listened to the podcast. And they talked about that, and they talked about the film. And it was just a really interesting discussion. So I'd like to recommend that one, if that's okay.
Thank you very much, Mark. Mark is being too kind because he knows that this is my podcast, my other podcast that I'm
in. It's very good. You've got a very good rapport with the other host, I have to say.
Oh, yeah. No, Steve's great. And, you know, he's we have a quite good rapport because he's Mr. Clever Bloke and I ask the questions.
If only I was cleverer, maybe we'd have had as good a rapport. Who knows?
You've never mentioned Steve before, Emma.
Well, maybe I'll get him on here. We can talk to him about popular culture.
Oh, right. Yeah, that'd be good.
If the government does anything on popular culture, we'll get him on.
No,
he won't.
I genuinely thought it was very good. I've listened to quite a lot of podcasts, and sometimes I listen to one episode and I think, Matt, and obviously I know you, so, you know, I was going to listen to it anyway. But actually, it was really good. I haven't listened to the other ones because I just haven't had much of a chance, but I genuinely will.
Another one coming out in the next couple of days. And there was a lovely Christmas special on It's a Wonderful Life. So there you go. That's all for you to come. Mm. Do please download that. And please do download A House of Comments. Please also rate and review us on iTunes because it does help other people to find us. And we are now back. We will be back on, I think, a fortnightly basis. So please do keep listening. Just before we go, I'd like to thank Nick and Mark, as always.
Pleasure.
Pleasure.
And also to thank Kevin McLeod at incompetech.com for our theme tune. And this has been a Political Human production.